Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're really getting into the United Nations. It's coming up on its 80th anniversary,
That's right.
and it feels like it's facing, a pretty intense midlife crisis. You've got geopolitical polarization, these massive existential threats, and a serious financial crunch.
Exactly. The world context is incredibly tough, highly polarized. We're dealing with, climate disasters, advanced AI risks, actual armed aggression, think Gaza, Ukraine. So to understand the UN today, you really need to look at two big intertwined things. First, the foundational document, the UN Charter itself. And second, this huge restructuring plan. The Secretary General's pushing the UN80 initiative. It's pretty controversial.
Right, and our sources really dig into both. We've got reports looking at the charter, asking if it's still relevant for modern cyber warfare. Then there's the UN80 plan, the budget cuts, merging departments, all that. And maybe the biggest piece, the political challenge from this strong sovereignty first idea. We saw that very clearly from U.S. President Donald Trump at the recent General Assembly.
It really is a fundamental test, a test for the whole idea of global cooperation.
Okay, let's unpack this. So let's start with the foundation, the UN Charter. This is basically the rule book for international relations, isn't it?
Essentially, yes, it's the constitutional bedrock.
Its origins, people often point to FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, but the first real outline was the Atlantic Charter with Churchill back in 41.
That's the genesis.
Ah.
That initial idea then got hammered out during the war, Moscow, Tehran, Yalta conferences. And then finally, 50 countries signed off in San Francisco, June 26, 1945.
And think about that timing. The war wasn't even officially over everywhere.
Exactly. But the need was so urgent. The U.S. Senate, which famously rejected the League of Nations after World War I, ratified the UN Charter almost immediately, an 89-2 vote. Overwhelming.
And what the sources stress is that despite everything, all the conflicts, the crises since 45, the charter itself, its core principles, they still stand. People often say it's honored more in the breach than in the observance.
Meaning countries ignore it all the time.
Right, but it's still the standard, the legal and sort of moral benchmark for all 193 members.
Precisely. It lays out the framework around five main pillars: peace and security, economic and social progress, human rights, international law, and peacemaking. What's really fascinating now is how you have to stretch those old pillars, reinterpret them, to cover threats the founders just couldn't have imagined.
Okay, let's dig into that tension. The use of force, Article 2.4, says states can't threaten or use force. But what is force today? The sources say that definition has just exploded.
That's the crucial point. It's not just tanks and missiles anymore.
So what else counts?
Well, the modern reading includes multidimensional threats, things like human-caused ecological disasters that cross borders, uncontrolled pandemics, major cyber attacks, like hacking a nation's power grid, even disrupting things from space. It's way beyond conventional military action.
Wait, so a state-sponsored hack on a power grid could be seen as an act of force under the charter?
Potentially, yes, that's the argument being made.
That really changes the game for self-defense, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And it puts enormous strain on another key part of the Charter Article 2.7. That's the one about sovereignty.
The clause that says the UN can't interfere in stuff that's essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of a country.
Right. But what happens when the crisis isn't neatly domestic? Think about a pandemic starting in one country but spreading globally, or mass migrations driven by climate change.
Those aren't just internal issues anymore.
Exactly. These huge transnational threats, pandemics, climate refugees, environmental collapse, they just overwhelm any single government. So relying purely on that domestic jurisdiction idea becomes, as one source put it, increasingly implausible.
The world's just too interconnected now.
The Charter's words are durable, but the reality is interdependence.
Okay, so the Charter does have tools for peace. Chapter 7 allows for military and non-military action, but we all know the Security Council is often deadlocked, right?
Yes, the P5 veto is a constant block. The five permanent members, US, UK, France, Russia, China, when they disagree, enforcement grinds to a halt.
But there's also self-defense, Article 51.
Correct. It confirms the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense. And with cyber warfare, drones, AI, the definition of what constitutes self-defense is constantly being pushed and broadened, way beyond 1945's understanding.
Beyond just defense or enforcement, there's also peacemaking. The General Assembly, the Secretary General.
Right. Article 14, for example, gives the General Assembly pretty broad power to recommend measures for the peaceful adjustment of any situation. It's quite open-ended.
And Article 99, the Secretary General's power.
Ah, yes, Article 99. It lets the SG bring any threat to peace directly to the Security Council. It's a proactive tool. Secretary General Guterres used it, at one source called it a cattle prod, regarding the Israel-Hamas war in late 2023.
So it still has teeth? Politically, at least?
It shows the Charter can still be a relevant political instrument, definitely. But its success always comes down to whether member states actually want to use it. Political will.
Okay, so if the Charter itself is adaptable, flexible enough maybe for AI and cyber threats, how's the actual organization doing? The UN bureaucracy?
Well, that leads us straight into the financial crisis and this huge restructuring plan, the UN80 initiative. Guterres launched it back in March 2025.
What's the main goal there? Just saving money?
It's framed as more than that. Survival, really. Guterres wants the UN to be more agile, more integrated, definitely more cost-effective, yes. But also more responsive to these huge global crises. Conflict, climate, tech risks.
Cost-effective sounds like a nice way of saying cuts. Big cuts.
Oh, they're significant. The secretary at the UN's main administrative body is apparently looking at cutting its $3.7 billion budget by 20%. That's for 2026.
20%? Wow. What does that mean in terms of jobs?
Well, estimates suggest it could mean around 6,900 job cuts out of a workforce of about 35,000. So yeah, this isn't just trimming the edges. It's a radical overhaul, trying to streamline what many see as a bloated system.
And it's not just jobs, right? They're looking at merging whole departments.
Absolutely. There's a task force memo mentioning over 50 potential mergers. The idea is to get rid of overlap, duplication of effort.
Like what? Give us some examples.
Okay, so things like potentially combining the UN's climate change body, the UNFCCC, with the UN Environment Program, UNEP, or folding the joint UN program on HIV/AIDS into the World Health Organization, the WHO, consolidating some of the human rights bodies. And there's apparently a lot of overlap between the agencies dealing with refugees and migrants they're targeted to.
So what's pushing this? Is it just about inefficiency, or is the UN actually running out of money?
It's overwhelmingly financial.
Yeah.
A crisis driven by member states simply not paying their dues, their assessed contributions. Projections show UN-wide resources could shrink by up to 30% by 2025. That impacts everything. Vaccinations, food aid, potentially affecting tens of millions of people.
How much are we talking about in unpaid dues?
The total backlog for the regular budget is around $2.4
billion. $2.4 billion. Who owes the most?
The biggest debtor, by a significant margin, is the United States, about $1.5 billion. That's more than half the total debt right there. After the U.S., it's China, owing around $597 million. Then Russia at $72 million, Saudi Arabia $42 million, Mexico and Venezuela around $38 million each. This debt isn't just symbolic. It creates operational paralysis.
And beyond the debt, there are the internal criticisms you mentioned. Bureaucratic bloat, slow decisions, duplication.
Right, like having three different UN agencies all working on food issues. It raises questions.
And does the Security Council gridlock play into this too? The P5 vetoes?
It absolutely worsens it. It fuels declining trust. When the Security Council is paralyzed by vetoes, especially in the face of major crises or atrocities, it undermines faith in the whole system. As one expert said, when the P5 disagree, the Council is generally paralyzed.
So, okay. The reforms seem necessary, at least financially, but they're facing pushback.
Oh, definitely. Significant political challenges. The most immediate worry is that these budget cuts will directly cause human suffering, that core programs, human rights, development aid, humanitarian assistance, will just be deprioritized or cut.
And what about the Global South? Developing countries?
They have serious concerns, too. They rely on UN technical assistance and funding for things like the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs.
Yeah.
They worry these reforms, driven by the budget crisis, will cut off that support. And while they hold a lot of votes in the General Assembly, this UN80 plan doesn't really address their biggest political demands, like getting permanent seats on the Security Council. It focuses on operational stuff, not the deep power structure.
Plus, there's a time limit, isn't there? Guterres' term is ending.
Exactly. His term ends in December 2026. There's a real question about whether his successor will have the mandate or the desire to push these controversial reforms through. The window for big structural change might be quite small.
So all this internal debate about reform is happening while externally there's this fundamental challenge to the very idea of working together internationally. That brings us to the sovereignty challenge.
Yes.
And President Trump's speech at the UN General Assembly in September 2025 really crystallized that, focusing hard on sovereignty, independence, national culture.
It was essentially a rejection of the whole premise of an international community bound by shared rules or values. he focused heavily on what he called the crisis of uncontrolled migration.
Claiming countries were being ruined by it.
Yes, and he went further, arguing the UN itself was funding an assault on Western countries and their borders by giving cash aid to refugees.
He also went after climate science pretty aggressively.
Very aggressively. Called the carbon footprint concept a hoax made up by stupid people. Dismissed the green economy push as a green energy scam, mm-hmm. and claimed credit for ending 7 unendable wars, contrasting that with the perceived failures of international cooperation.
What's the deeper implication of that kind of rhetoric?
Well, if you reject the idea of shared humanity, of shared global responsibility, you basically undermine the entire foundation for things like universal human rights or the duty to protect the global environment. Those concepts rely on cooperation that goes beyond just what one country wants.
And this isn't just talk, right? The U.S. under this administration has taken concrete actions against the U.N. system.
Very concrete. For the 2026 fiscal year, the plan eliminates almost all U.S. funding for the U.N. system and for peacekeeping operations.
That's not just falling behind on dues, that's actively defunding.
It's a deliberate strategy. Remember, Trump pulled the U.S. out of the World Health Organization right after taking office. He dismantled USAI and the Millennium Challenge Corporation, key development agencies, and maintained the funding freeze on UNRWA, the Agency for Palestinian Refugees. These are direct hits on international cooperation.
But the sources push back on this, don't they? They make a case for why multilateralism actually helps powerful countries like the U.S.
They do. The core argument is burden sharing.
Yeah.
The U.S. pays 22% of the U.N.'s regular budget. That's significant, yes, but it avoids the U.S. having to fund 100% of comparable global programs on its own to achieve similar goals.
Like what kind of goals?
Things the U.N. system does advance. Economic development in poorer countries, global public health initiatives, think vaccine campaigns and peacekeeping operations that can stabilize regions without costing American lives or treasure directly.
And then there are the problems that just ignore borders entirely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You can't tackle nuclear proliferation country by country. Or massive refugee flows, or even something like illegal fishing, which sounds specific, but actually impacts the food security and livelihoods of billions of people worldwide.
Trying to handle those purely through a national sovereignty lens just doesn't work.
Right. The argument is that isolationism ultimately just guarantees instability that will eventually impact everyone, including the isolationist power.
It's pretty ironic, though. Trump didn't even mention the UN 80 reform plan in his big speech.
No, he didn't.
But by cutting off the funding, his administration is essentially forcing its own kind of reform on the UN anyway, remaking it through, well, financial starvation.
That's a key takeaway. The political rhetoric might reject the Charter's principles, but the financial actions are actively reshaping the organization's future structure, regardless of Guterres' plans.
So wrapping this up, what does it all mean for you trying to make sense of the UN's role today? On one hand, we have this foundational document, the Charter. Experts argue it's actually quite resilient, conceptually strong enough to grapple with 21st century threats like AI or cyber warfare. But the organization it created, it's facing gridlock, staggering debt, and these radical restructuring efforts driven partly by necessity, partly by political attack.
The fundamental tension is right there. It's between the enduring words and principles of the Charter and the actual political will or lack thereof from its most powerful members to live up to them and pay for them.
Yeah.
So the big question becomes, does it even matter if we cleverly reinterpret the Charter for modern times if the major powers just refuse to fund the system or cooperate through it?
And here's a final thought for you to mull over. The UN Charter was signed in June 1945. That was less than 2 months before Hiroshima and Nagasaki ushered in the nuclear age. Think about that. The entire reality of nuclear weapons, the terminology, the existential threat, it's completely absent from the Charter's text.
They couldn't conceive of it then.
Exactly. So if the founders couldn't imagine nuclear weapons, what completely new existential challenge, something we're maybe only dimly aware of today, will force the next unavoidable rethinking of the Charter's core principles? What stands out to YU? We hope this deep dive has given you a clearer picture of the huge challenges and changes facing the UN and the whole system of global governance right now.